couple of announcements I'd like to share with you before we begin. I just want to let you know that the calendars are in. Most of you who are here today who have ordered them have already received yours. If you haven't, you can get them after worship or after Sunday school and pay for them either today or next week. I only charge 50% interest, so not to worry. If you have to write a check, I would ask that you make the check out to me since I'm collecting the money. Then I can cash the money and see that it goes to where it needs to go. The money that we collect from the sale of these calendars by the Women's Missionary Society, other than paying for the calendars themselves, helps to give a Christmas gift to the missionaries that we have in Taiwan, the two that we send gifts to, the Christoffersons and the Kittlesons. Speaking of the Women's Missionary Society, I'll reiterate what was mentioned this morning. There are a few angel tags left, and the gifts have to be brought back by next Sunday, so hopefully by the end of this morning all of the tags will be gone. At their last regular meeting in October, the Women's Missionary Society, at my suggestion, sent a check of $100 to Congregation Bethel in Sunbury. Many of you have been following in the paper how they have torn down their synagogue and are building a new one. I felt it would be appropriate for us as a way of expressing solidarity with the Jewish community in our area. Since we have so much to learn from them that will deepen our own understanding of Jesus Christ, and to let them know that we were supportive of them. So we sent that check a few weeks ago, and I received a thank you from them, from Congregation Bethel, dated November 18th, 2006, or if you're following the Jewish calendar, dated the month of Heshvan, the 27th day of the year 5767. Dear Reverend McCarty and the New Hope Lutheran Brethren Church, on behalf of the Capital Campaign Committee and Congregation Bethel, please accept our heartfelt thank you. Your donation to our fundraising drive enables us to move closer to realizing the dream of a new space for worship, education, and enrichment. We deeply appreciate your support in sustaining our Jewish community. Once again, thank you for your generous contribution. And it's signed Janet Schwartz Byron, the chairperson for the synagogue campaign. Also received another thank you in the mail. That's having to do with some goodies that were sent out before the Thanksgiving holiday. Dear friends and family of New Hope, thank you for the delicious cookies and other treats. This is the third year now that I've gotten cookies from you. But I always forget that they're coming, and I'm very delighted and surprised when I get them. Well, no taking for granted there, huh? School has been very hectic this year with graduation and post-graduation plans on my mind, along with the usual load. I'm looking forward to the holidays and a much-needed break. Thank you for your thoughts and prayers. It means more to me than you may know, and it's signed with love from Heidi Hedding. Well, I made one mistake in the bulletin this week with the anthem. I have a second thing to make note of. It's not a mistake, but it's a change. And since I'm the one who made the plans, I can change them. With Christmas coming, I have decided to postpone our continuation of our study through the Bible. We will not be reading 1 Kings until January. So the message of 1 and 2 Kings, the history of it, and the length of the book doesn't seem quite appropriate for the Advent season. And so we will be doing other things for the next few weeks, and we'll get back to 1 Kings. So if you really want to be aggressive in your study of the Bible, I'd suggest that you continue your reading and try to read through 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles by the middle of January, because those books have a lot of history in them, and actually Chronicles is a repetition, for the most part, of what's in 2 Samuel and the books of Kings. So the more familiar you are with the overall history, the more the events, I think, will take on meaning for you. And I don't really think anyone's going to, not too many people anyway, are going to be disappointed that we're not going to be reading Kings during December. We will be decorating, I should say they will be decorating the tree after Sunday school this morning. We let the tree decorations go from last week and decided we will put them on this week, although the tree looks very nice with the ribbon and the lights. Had a bit of a surprise this morning. I plugged the tree in when I first came in, and when I come up to get things ready for the sound system, the lights weren't working. And I was very frustrated because we put our tree up yesterday and we had that problem with quite a few lights. And it turns out for some reason or other the circuit for the outlets here was blown. I don't know if with the coffee and the tree and everything else it was too much or what, but they're working now, so I'm grateful for that. On a little more somber note, I want to share with you two events that happened this past week to inform your prayers. Earlier in the week, Ann McDonald had a fall at her house. She was going out with the garbage and she fell in the driveway. Her neighbor looked up and saw her, and she was sitting on the stoop at the time, and went up and asked her if she was okay, and got her in the house, and she fell again in the house. So they took her called their doctor. She was due for some tests this week, and he said, well, bring her to the office, and I'll admit her directly into the hospital, and then we can do these tests anyway. So they've done all the tests, and yesterday I got a call that she returned home. To my knowledge, the tests were inconclusive so far. We've heard that before, haven't we? And so I just ask that you would keep Anne in your prayer. She does have a lot of weakness in her right leg, a lot of pain and a lot of lower back pain, so as well as osteoporosis. So I'm just grateful the fall didn't result in any broken bones. So apparently the medicine she's been on for the osteoporosis has been doing some good. Because they told her, this was while Ted was still living, they told her that one more fall and she'd be in really serious shape. So glad that it didn't result in that. Speaking of falling, Gerald Mowry fell at home on his way out to the van to go to the senior center. He fell and was not able to get help for about an hour and a half. When Todd came to work, he found him and called 911. He bruised his side pretty bad. He fell on a flower box and bruised his side and apparently damaged his liver because there was bleeding. He's on Coumadin, which many of you are familiar with, that thins the blood, and apparently there was a lot of bleeding, or at least the x-ray revealed a lot of fluid around the liver. So he's at Geisinger and will be under observation until they figure out exactly what the results of the fall were and make arrangements for it. So you want to keep him in your prayers. And last, and unfortunately, most difficult of all, many of you know that Len Karras has been having trouble with his sugar in the last few days. Friday, I stopped at the house, and that morning he had not been alert, and Doris tried to revive him and couldn't, and called the 911. And they came and they were able to revive him. His sugar was very low and they gave him sugar water and got him back to consciousness again and so forth, and he was okay Friday. But yesterday morning she went into his room and it was the same thing. She couldn't revive him and she called 911. This time they couldn't revive him either. In fact, I think before he was even in the hospital, they had intubated him. They put a tube down his throat for breathing. And he's in intensive care at Evangelical. He's not responsive. He's on a ventilator. Things aren't looking real good. I stopped in last evening fairly late, and there was a nurse in there with him doing checking, doing some tests, and the lady from the intensive care, who I guess is his nurse, came over to me right away and introduced herself. And I told her who I was. I said, I'm Dave McCarty, I'm Len's pastor. And she said, well, why don't you go ahead and go in? She said, you won't bother the woman that's in there. Go over to his bedside and have prayer with him if you want. He can use it. He's a very sick man. So we want to keep Len and Doris in your prayers. They called Roger in, and he was coming in today. So that family is going to need your prayers and support today and in the next few days, I'm sure. Very grateful we have a God we can call on any time and find him usually already at work. So. Well, this morning I faced the same problem I've been facing all along. It may be a challenge for you to read through a whole book of the Bible every week, especially the longer books of the Old Testament. The real challenge for me is knowing what to talk about because there's just so much material. And 2 Samuel, I don't know about you, but I found 2 Samuel to be the easiest reading of all the books we've had so far, except maybe for Ruth. But I noticed a pattern that repeated itself in the history of Israel and particularly in the family of David. And it's this pattern I'd like to talk about this morning. I'd like to begin by reading a portion of the 14th chapter of 2 Samuel. This takes place after a lot of events have happened in the family, personal events in the family life of David. His eldest son Amnon has raped his daughter, Amnon's half-sister Tamar. Tamar's full brother Absalom has been simmering with anger, and after a period of time he took matters into his own hands and killed his half-brother Amnon in retribution. And all of this has created a lot of unrest in the family, and David is dealing with it in his usual way, which is to say he's not dealing with it. And Absalom has felt estranged from David because David, his father, won't talk to him. Although he doesn't do anything in terms of punishing Absalom for what he's done, they have no relationship. And Absalom is sort of in a self-imposed exile, and the advisors to the king are going to try and see if they can't bring resolution to this. So in the 14th chapter, we read that Joab, the son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart longed for Absalom, and so Joab sent someone to Tekoa and had a wise woman brought to him from there. He said to her, "Pretend you're in mourning. Dress in mourning clothes and don't use any cosmetic lotions. Act like a woman who has spent many days grieving for the dead. Then go to the king and speak these words to him." And Joab put the words in her mouth. When the woman from Tekoa went to the king, she fell with her face to the ground to pay him honor, and she said, "Help me, O king." The king asked her, "What is troubling you?" She said, "I am indeed a widow. My husband is dead. I, your servant, had two sons. They got into a fight with each other in the field, and no one was there to separate them. One struck the other and killed him." Talk about sibling rivalry. "Now the whole clan has risen up against your servant. They say, 'Hand over the one who struck his brother down so that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. Then we will get rid of the heir as well. They would put out the only burning coal I have left, leaving my husband neither name nor descendant on the face of the earth.' The king said to the woman, 'Go home, and I will issue an order in your behalf.' But the woman from Tekoa said to him, 'My lord the king, let the blame rest on me and on my father's family, and let the king and his throne be without guilt.' The king replied, 'If anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he won't bother you again.' And she said, Then let the king invoke the Lord his God to prevent the avenger of blood from adding to the destruction, so that my son will not be destroyed. As surely as the Lord lives, David said, not one hair of your son's head will fall to the ground. And the woman said, let your servant speak a word to my lord the king. He replied, speak. The woman said, why then have you devised a thing like this against the people of God? When the king says this, does he not convict himself? For the king has not brought back his banished son. Like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be recovered, so we must die. But God does not take away life. Instead, he devises ways so that a banished person may not remain estranged from him. And now I have come to say this to my lord the king because the people have made me afraid. Your servant thought, I will speak to the king. Perhaps he will do what his servant asks. Perhaps the king will agree to deliver his servant from the hand of the man who's trying to cut off both me and my son from the inheritance God gave us. And now your servant says, may the word of my lord the king bring me rest. For my lord the king is like an angel of God in discerning good and evil. May the Lord your God be with you. Then the king said to the woman, don't keep from me the answer to what I'm going to ask you. Let my lord the king speak, the woman said. The king asked, isn't the hand of Joab with you in all this? The woman answered, as surely as you live, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right or to the left from anything my lord the king says. Yes, it was your servant Joab who instructed me to do this and who put all these words into the mouth of your servant. Your servant Joab did this to change the present situation. My Lord has wisdom like that of an angel of God. He knows everything that happens in the land. The king said to Joab, very well, I will do it. Go, bring back the young man, Absalom. Wonder if that scene seemed familiar to you. Joab's using the same tactic that Nathan used earlier when David sinned with Bathsheba. He didn't come out directly and confront David with his sin. Instead, he told David a story which would get David's sympathies on a certain side and then enable Nathan to show the king that the king was actually convicting himself when he passed judgment. I read this story many, many times when I was younger. And then several years ago, I think probably for something like this through the Bible, I was reading it again, and for the first time I was really struck by what the woman from Tekoa said to the king. And since then I've used that passage in many funerals, because it seemed to me a very appropriate thing to say. Like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be recovered, so we must die. But God does not take away life. Instead, he devises ways so that a banished person may not remain estranged from him. Every now and then, in reading through the Old Testament, I come across a verse like this that seems to summarize so powerfully what God was doing in Jesus Christ. And it amazes me to think that the Old Testament, this written about events that took place 1,000 years before the birth of Christ, could so powerfully grasp the message of Jesus' ministry. I really don't know of any other place in the Old Testament, or even in the New for that matter, which expresses with such power and such tenderness the message of the cross. In today's paper, the Daily Item, you know, every now and then they'll sort of ask the man in the street a question. You know, what do you want for Christmas, or what do you have for Thanksgiving dinner? Question this morning, are you religious? And the answers were, yes, I'm religious, I go to church. I'm kind of religious, I believe in God, but I don't go to church. No, I'm not religious. That sort of thing. And there's always seems to be kind of a struggle between people who are religious and people who aren't. In Jesus' time, it was the Pharisees, in the days of the disciples. I don't like to say in Jesus' time because it's still his time today. But in the days of the disciples, it was the Pharisees who were the religious people. And very often there were people coming to faith, and their way to faith was being obstructed by the religious people instead of encouraged. And very often when we come to an understanding of what God means in our lives, we can lose sight of who God really is and think only in terms of what God means to me personally, and then have a tendency to be judgmental about the way other people perceive of God or worship God. But in this passage we're reminded of something of the character of God. The Bible teaches us that from the time of almost since the time of creation, since the time when Adam and Eve joined in eating the forbidden fruit, we have been estranged from God. And there are many people who, when they become religious, want to keep that estrangement. They want to make it very clear that there are certain people who are estranged from God, but as for me personally, I'm on the right side. I'm with God, and the whole world is against God. We forget that what God did in sending Jesus Christ to us was to go out of his way to, in the words of this wise woman from Tekoa, to devise a way so that those who are banished, those who are separated from God, those who whose relationship with God is broken, might be restored. We know this is an important aspect of God, of the ministry of Jesus Christ, because in 2 Corinthians, Paul tells us that it is. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, in particular, Paul has these words to say. All this is from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. And again, in Colossians chapter 1, Paul says this: once you were alienated from God, you were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior, but now God has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight without blemish and free from accusation. If you continue in your faith, established and firmed, not moved from the hope held out in the gospel. This is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant. The New Testament testifies that through Christ, God was devising a way in which banished humanity might not remain estranged from him. Unfortunately, in the case of David and Absalom, the attempt at reconciliation was not successful. And I leave it to the psychologist to explain why. If you read the book, you know the story. Absalom was brought back to Jerusalem. David hugged him, expressed his love for him. But they remained estranged. There was a distance between them. And after a while, Absalom complained to Joab and said, "Why did you bother bringing me back to Jerusalem? I might as well be living in exile. I'm living in exile here in the city. My father has nothing to do with me. He doesn't talk to me." In saying that, I suppose Absalom is expressing the thought of many people throughout history, and particularly in our own day and age, who have a problem with the world. You've heard the expression, when someone just seems to react toward everyone with bitterness or anger, they'll say, he's mad at the world. And there are people who are mad at the world, but the reason is because there is no one who talks to them. No father, for many no mother. They're alone, and they don't know how to deal with it. The story of David's family is a story of unfulfilled relationships. We see the pattern over and over again. It's the mechanism that makes soap operas so successful. Incomplete communication. There's a problem that comes up, and instead of doing what we have already discovered that God does, we saw this all the way back in the book of Genesis, when an outcry came up about Sodom, that the city was so sinful, God didn't just say, okay, I'm going to judge the city. He came down and he investigated the claim. When the blood of Abel cried out after Abel was murdered by Cain, God came to Cain and he talked to him. But the pattern in David's own family, and indeed in the whole history of Israel, it seems, is a pattern of one person does something that offends somebody else, sometimes deliberately and sometimes not deliberately. And instead of coming together and talking to reconcile, they automatically take action against each other, and the whole situation escalates until it explodes. We see this example over and over again. For example, in the book of 2 Samuel, we see the situation where God, where David brings the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem, and on the way, the ox stumbles and the Ark starts to slide off of the cart, and the man Uzzah reaches out his hand to steady the Ark, and he's struck dead by God. And David is angry, but he's also afraid. But he doesn't talk to anybody about this. He doesn't approach God and say, why did you strike Uzzah? If he had, God no doubt would have said to him, don't you know the law of Moses that says any time the ark is to be moved, it's to be moved by poles? It's not to be put on an ox cart. It's to be carried by poles. If you had done this, this wouldn't have happened. But instead, David just reacts in fear and says, I'm not touching that ark. I'm going to leave it right where it is. When David wanted to build the temple, he told his advisor Nathan, he says, I want to build a temple for God. And Nathan says, go ahead, do whatever you want to do. God is with you. Nathan didn't bother asking God. Sounded like a good idea to Nathan, so he just said, go ahead. And only later that night was God able to confront Nathan and say, David's not building the temple. His son might, but he won't. One of the best examples of this in 2 Samuel is in the 10th chapter, when David sends a delegation with gifts to Hunan, a neighboring king whose father had just died. And Hunan's advisors say to him, now you don't think David is really sending this to you because he's grieving over your father's death, do you? He's sending these people as spies to scout out the land. And instead of investigating the issue, the king automatically brings these people into him and treats them shamefully and sends them back home. And then David, instead of investigating and understanding what happened and why it happened, reacts the way you would expect a king to react. He started a war. He gathered his army together and he went to battle. David shows the same attitude in the situation with Bathsheba. He knows what he's doing is wrong, but he does it anyway. And when he can't get out of it, he arranges the murder of one of his most beloved heroes, Uriah the Hittite. Of course, the situation with Amnon was the same. And David, like Eli, didn't even seem to be aware of what was happening in his family. And when David did nothing about it, Absalom must have figured, well, if nobody else will do something, I will. My sister's honor is at stake. And David apparently cared nothing for the honor or the peace of his own family. We see it again later when David runs out of Jerusalem, when Absalom tries to take over the country. And the son of Saul, who remained, who was brought into David's care, Mephibosheth, if you remember, he was lame. And so he doesn't go out with David. He stays in the city. But his servant does go out, and he says to David, well, Mephibosheth decided, now that David's gone, I'll just cozy up to Absalom, and Absalom will take care of me. Made Mephibosheth look like a traitor. Does David investigate it? No, he takes the word of his servant and finds out only later that what Mephibosheth did, he did out of concern for the king, not wanting the king to be saddled with a cripple. Now in 1 Kings, we see a situation very similar with Saul. Saul finds out that David has been had stopped by the place where the Ark of the Covenant was, and that the priest Abiathar had inquired of the Lord on his behalf. And instead of thinking that the priest was just doing what he thought he should do for the servant of the king automatically assumed that it was the conspiracy between David and the priest, and he had the priest and his family and the entire city killed. And this is how anger and bitterness and vengeance works on us. We may be angry at something or at someone, and if we don't deal with it, pretty soon the anger hits everybody around us. It just spills over like a pot that's boiling. And everyone is damaged by it, and the original reason for the anger and the bitterness is totally forgotten. But in one case, we see a little bit different pattern. Remember the story of David from 1 Samuel, of David and Nabal. David's men had protected Nabal's sheep and shepherds. And one day his men were hungry, and David sent word to Nabal and said, would you please give us something to eat? And Nabal treated them arrogantly and said, forget it. Who's David? There's all kinds of people around trying to announce themselves king. And so David says to himself, well, a lot of good it did us to protect this guy and his shepherds. We'll go out and destroy them. And he was on his way to destroy them. And Nabal's wife demonstrated the pattern of God. She said, I'm not going to let this problem continue. I'm going to seek reconciliation. And she went to David, and David said to her afterwards, he said, you may be sure that you saved your husband's life. Because if you hadn't come to me, not only he, but all the men under his care would have been killed, would have been dead by morning. So every now and then we see an exception to it, but by and large the pattern with David and his family is the same as the pattern so often is with us. When there's a disruption of relationship, there's no seeking of reconciliation. There's no seeking of understanding. It's like a boxing match where every person goes into their respective corners and they nurse their grudges and they come out fighting. This wise woman of Tekoa, isn't it interesting that reconciliation in both in the case of Absalom and in the case of Nabal and his shepherds, that reconciliation came at the instigation of women. Abigail, Nabal's wife, and this wise woman from Tekoa decided that estrangement is not the way to live. That perhaps life is too short, or that perhaps there's so much that we miss, or perhaps a life that's spoiled by the poison of bitterness is not worth living, and that maybe the cost of reconciliation is worth it if we can live a life freed from anger and distress and bitterness. The New Testament confirms for us that God, like the wise woman of Tekoa, said, God is one who does not want us to remain estranged from Him. And He went to the cross in order to, in her words, devise a way so that those who were estranged from Him might no longer be estranged. But that's not the end of the story. Because if you remember that lesson from 2 Corinthians where Paul says that God was reconciling us to himself in Christ, he went on to say that in turn he makes us ambassadors of his to spread that message of reconciliation to others. And those of us who have tried to pass on the message of the reconciliation that's possible between us and God through Jesus Christ have often found that we cannot talk about to another person about being reconciled with God until we first have dealt with our own issues that need reconciliation. How can I tell a member of my family to be reconciled to God when I'm not reconciled with that member of my family? How can I hope to be a witness in my neighborhood when there are people in my neighborhood that I'm not reconciled with? There are issues between us. The Bible tells us we're not to be in debt to anyone except the debt of love. And Jesus himself even speaks of our need to be reconciled with one another. He says in Matthew during the Sermon on the Mount, he says, if your brother has something against you, why don't you go to him and try to resolve the issue? Because if you don't, you might end up standing in front of a court of law. And you might just find that your brother has a case against you and you end up in jail. And Jesus is speaking about more than earthly jail. He's reminding us that whatever offenses we commit against one another will follow us to heaven. And when we stand before God in judgment, when I stand before God in judgment, it will not only be the words of God that condemn me. It will not only be my own words that condemn me, but everyone in my life that I've offended will have an opportunity to stand on in that court and say to God, "You cannot save this man because this is what he has done to me. And this offense has not been paid for." What will it be like for you on that day of judgment if you stand before God and God says to you, "Well, for my part, I am reconciled with you because of your faith in Jesus Christ. But I have a list of claims here from a variety of people in your life, and these claims have not been paid for. And these are still outstanding." You see, what we do against God has been taken care of in the cross, but what we do against one another, that's business we need to resolve. Alcoholics Anonymous have been very successful for the last couple of generations. One of their most powerful steps in the 12-step program is to sit down and make an inventory of all the people that I have hurt in my life, particularly through my addiction, and as far as possible try to make amends with them. I cannot be at peace with God if I have not done everything that I can do to devise ways that I might be restored to those whom I have banished from my heart. And on the other hand, if I know that God has been willing to go to the cross on my behalf, if he would go this far in order to try reconciliation between himself and me, who am I to withhold any attempt at reconciliation from my fellow man or woman? If God has paid such a high price for me, how can I remain estranged from my fellow man? No wonder Jesus says that the way of the cross is a narrow way and a straight way and a difficult way. It's very easy for me to accept what God has done for me. But now, can I allow God to work in me in such a way that he will help me to develop his character, and I, like he, will do what I can to restore relationships that are broken in my life? Of course, there's no way every relationship can be restored. God has certainly discovered that though he sent Jesus into the world to provide a way of reconciliation for all people, only a small minority of the people who have ever lived will take advantage of that reconciliation. And yet God made the attempt. In the same way, I may try to bring about reconciliation with people in my life and find that they are resistant and I must let them go. But at least I will know that I have done what I could to try to restore broken relationships and mend damage that has been done, whether by them or by me. And then I will make it my goal not to hold against them either what stands between us or their unwillingness to forgive. This is the pattern that Jesus has given me, the pattern I must develop for my own life. David had trouble developing this pattern in his life, and the brokenness in his own family and in his own personal life went on to do irreparable damage to the nation of Israel. Because it remains true that the more powerful my position, the more damage is done by the sins I commit. David tried and he failed. He failed miserably in the case of Absalom. And he wouldn't have even tried if Joab hadn't worked out a way of trying to get David to see what he needed to do. I'm sure there are many areas in my life where this attempt at reconciliation is needed, where I need to develop more of the heart of God, not a condemning heart, but a heart that seeks reconciliation and peace. And I don't imagine I'll ever successfully deal with every area of my life that needs to be dealt with. But perhaps as I see the pattern in David's life and see the damage that it did, and perhaps as I look to the cross and see what God has done for me, as I receive his love and am healed by his love, perhaps there will be more of that example in my life and less of the example of the bitter and broken Absalom. Heavenly Father, we pray that as we reflect on the love which led you to send your own Son to the cross, we might be mindful of our need to be reconciled to you. We might be thankful for what you have done. And we might find your Spirit working in us in such a way that we find areas of brokenness in our own lives and find ways, devise ways, to seek reconciliation. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Would the ushers please come forward for the offering?